Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is our first episode of 2024 and kicking off my fifth year of hosting this show. Pretty awesome. This is Liz joining you as usual from Central Virginia, the unceded ancestral lands of the Monacan Nation. And if you would like to know whose native lands you might be residing on, please be sure to check out native-land.ca. I will put that in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're tuning in today. If you are interested in learning more about the sacred feminine, there are all kinds of ways you could do that, but I can tell you a few that are related to me. First, you can check out my award-winning book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine from Womancraft Publishing. It's available wherever you buy your books. You can check out the classes that are available via the Home to Her Academy. In the midst of teaching two classes right now, and we'll be rolling out new courses in collaboration with some really amazing teachers all year long. So be sure to check that out and get on the newsletter so you can make sure you know what's coming out. And then you can also follow me on social media. I'm at Home to Her on Instagram and Facebook, maybe TikTok one of these days. I don't know. I'm working on it. And also there's a Facebook group also called Home to Her. With a lot of people in it from around the world. So if you're interested in being in dialogue with others on this subject, you can check that out too. And then if you go to hometoher.com, you'll find some articles, all past podcast episodes will be there as well. And don't worry, I'll put all that in the show notes. And if you are a regular listener, or even if this is your first time tuning into the show and you really enjoy it, I'd love for you to leave a review wherever you might access this. That would be super helpful. It always helps people find this information. And given that culturally we are not drowning in information about the divine feminine, I think any way we can help people find this information is good. And then as always, feel free to reach out to me with your thoughts, your comments, your feedback, your suggestions. Social media is a really good way to do that. I love hearing from you. If you don't hear back from me right away, that doesn't mean I didn't hear you. I will. It just sometimes takes a little time, but I always appreciate hearing what you think. All right. And now, on with our show. So I'm so honored to have my guest joining me today. And as I began to explore her work, I felt that immediately I had discovered a kindred spirit. And I want to read you something that I feel illustrates this, which is, I think, from the very first page of her book, where I had an, aha, this is so lovely. But she writes about, specifically about having a thirst, one that she hopes is a shared one. And as she writes, she says, it's a thirst for conversations with women, women of our times, contemporary women, women who improvise their way through their lives even as we speak, women walking the spiritual path right now, sometimes confidently, sometimes haltingly, but who still feel compelled to walk it. And I felt that in a way, this could also describe the very thirst that inspired me to start this podcast and inspires me to continue to do it year after year. So I've been really looking forward to this conversation and to sharing this with you all. So let me go ahead and introduce her to you now. Described as one of the finest poets writing in India today, Arundhati Subramaniam is a leading Indian poet and award-winning author of 14 books of poetry and prose. Recent books include the poetry volume, Love Without a Story, a prose work on four contemporary women on spiritual journeys, Women Who Wear Only Themselves, and an anthology of female sacred poetry in India, Wild Women. She has worked over the years as a curator, critic, and poetry editor. A recipient of the Sahitya Academy Award in 2020 and shortlisted for the prestigious T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry in 2015, her awards include the inaugural Khushwant Singh Prize, the Il Ceppo Prize in Italy, among numerous others. And she is joining us today from her home in Chennai, India. Arundhati, thank you so much for being here. It's an honor to have you with me.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you. And I'm delighted to be here.
Wonderful. Well, I listeners of the show know this. I always love to start with my guests and hearing about their spiritual backgrounds growing up. And there's a twofold reason for that. One is I'm just curious. I like to hear this from guests. And the other is really related to this conversation, since this is a spiritual conversation of what you experienced growing up and what is the through line for you to where you are now, if there is one, or were there things that shaped you that were very clearly pointing you to where you are today, or things perhaps that you had to leave behind? So I'd love to start there if that's all right with you.
A great place to start, and curiosity is a great place to start too. So, yeah, it also gives me a chance to reflect on this because I wonder, Liz, how much of it I had to drop and how much I really had to, how much of it was just scraping away superfluous stuff so I could allow something that was always there to emerge. I'd say I grew up with parents who were liberal. Very decidedly urban. I grew up in a city of many names, Bombay, Mumbai, Bombay. It has many, many names and faces. It's a city of many languages and a city of many cultures. So I grew up Hindu, culturally Hindu, but the thing of the kind of liberal, unorthodox Hindu that many people in my parents' time were and continue to be, I think, which is not at all ritualistic, not at all dogmatic in any way. So I grew up with the sounds, certainly, of certain Sanskrit shlokas very much in the air, shlokas as in sacred utterances. Those were very much in the air. There was a lot of classical music, which was, as many people in India know, it's suffused with sacred content. So classical music was in the air. And there was a certain spirit of devotion, or what we call bhakti in India, which I know was very much part of my mother's journey. It was an unspoken journey. And I don't think we ever sat down and discussed it. And I think my father had his own journey, which he talked to me about when I was all of 10. But in many ways, he would have been perceived and would perhaps even have defined himself as an agnostic, but as a seeker in his own way, very drawn to Eastern philosophy rather than any kind of religious practice. So that's the background I grew up in. And looking back on it, Liz, I'm actually grateful because I've had friends who've actually spent a great deal of time battling against a lot of their inheritance, which I didn't have to do simply because the inheritance was just capacious and hospitable and not terribly oppressive. So I grew up with lots of books, books of poetry, and lots of philosophy. That was very much part of the bookshelf, along with history, my father's bookshelves. And that had an enduring impact. And somewhere along the way, probably in my teens, like everyone else, I was besieged by questions. I probably had them even when I was in my sing in single digits, questions about life and living and what's it about, why is life so perishable and why, what is loss about and what is the whole business of living and dying about? Nothing new about any of that. Everyone's had it. I had my share of questions. And I believed that my answers would come as I grew up. I thought my answers would come from poetry, that they would come from the arts, because that was my domain. That was the area that I felt happiest in. And certainly, what I did find was that in the arts, I was allowed to at least ask certain questions. And it felt like there were writers and artists from time immemorial who'd asked those questions. That helped, but it wasn't enough. And so at some point in my life, my reading moved from just philosophy to reading the mystics. And that took on an urgency and a feverishness. And my own experience at some point in my life, this happened to me in 1997, it was an experience of a kind of wordlessness which felt to me like death. And from that experience, I think I emerged just humbler and willing to be surprised and bewildered. And at that time, I think a lot of what I had learned, perhaps academically or cerebrally, just did not seem to be enough. I was looking for guidance. And so I think all the reading that I did in some way prepared me, but the real answer came to me when I started seeking spiritual guidance. And I'm not sure we want, is that adequate for this part of your question, or do you want to talk about the spirit? Do you want me to start talking about how that journey unfolded as well?
I do want to get to that, but I want to pause here because I want to ask you about this. I would love for you to say more about the wordlessness that felt like death. Can you say more about what that was and why that felt like death to you?
It was an experience that I had never had before and I had never had since, and I'm not sure what triggered it. I was coming back from Nepal after a particularly relaxed vacation, and I happened to be reading the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, which may have had something to do with it. But I've read books before and books that have grabbed me, but nothing that really catalyzed anything like this. But it felt to me like I was, I reached home, I reached Bombay, and it felt to me like I was just dying. And I thought the experience would pass. It was a strange feeling. I thought it would pass. But I woke up the next day feeling absolutely the same way. And I almost felt like I could see my body darkening, hardening into a kind of carcass-like stiffness. It was a strange experience, a terrifying experience.
Yeah.
And it helped me see at that point that all that I had read, or all I had imagined, or what I had extrapolated from what I had read, you know, ideas of joy and, you know, what in India we call Satchidananda, the ultimate truth is joy, and all of that, everything came crumbling. And I was just left with a sense of a great emptiness and, you know, nothing that I had considered important in my life at that point, until that point, none of it seemed to matter. And that it really, and even words were ashes in the mouth. So there were many, it was a week, but it seemed like a very long, it was seemed like an interminable week. And as I started coming out of that, and it, thankfully the experience started receding, and as I started coming out of it, suddenly life seemed richer and more alive than ever before. Colors seemed brighter than ever before. But one thing was clear to me. I was very relieved that it was receding, but it was clear to me that I could no longer just go back to being who I thought I was, or who I perhaps pretended to be, you know, entirely. That I was lots of other things. I was a closet seeker, in a sense. And I think I had to come out of the closet, at least to myself, and acknowledge that I was not just a poet and a curator and a journalist and, you know, all those things I did because I enjoyed them. But I realized I was much more than that, and much more fundamentally, I was a seeker and I desperately needed guidance.
That resonates with me so much. And I can feel into what I would imagine the terror of losing words for someone who's a writer. And who, you know, identifies and expresses in that way, and I resonate with that. The metaphor that's coming to mind is, you know, having the spiritual rug pulled out from under you, or you know, the ground shaking.
Absolutely.
Or quaking. Like what was there is no longer there. Yeah.
I had a poem which I wrote much later, but I think I wrote that after I met my spiritual guide, which happened 7 years later. And at that time I said it was a bit like opening my coffee percolator and finding my roof having flown off. You know, you're sort of doing something terribly small and mundane, and you know, the entire architecture of your life has changed.
Yes. I've had a similar experience, not the same, of course. It took its own flavor, but yes. And I love that you use the language, what did you say, a closeted seeker? Because I think I've used the exact same language to describe myself before I began doing this work. So that really, really resonates with me. And I do want to hear about your spiritual journey. And I want to know, I'm certain these things are going to weave together, but I think I do want to, I want to ask you specifically about the divine feminine. And I often ask about it at this point of the show when I'm speaking to women who have been raised in the United States, because so often there is a concealment of the goddess, the sacred feminine. We don't have a connection to her. And so there is a revealing or an awakening or an understanding of like, whoa, 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 like, where, how did I not get this before? And also when I speak to women who have a Hindu background or have been raised in another tradition, it's entirely different. You know, there's like, of course she's there. She's been there since I was born. But I would love to hear you talk about your understanding of the sacred feminine. Was that really woven through your existence from as far as you can remember, or how would you describe that?
That's a wonderful question. I think even when I met my spiritual guide, my guru, in 2004, one part of me just wished, you know, he had been a woman, because I'd always thought that's where my guidance would come from. I was, you know, I liked the idea of having some kind of to having a female guide, but that didn't happen, and it didn't matter. All right, I was just grateful for guidance, and the guidance came my way, and I remain grateful for. Yes, it is true that as someone who grew up in India and as someone who grew up Hindu, images of the goddess are all around you from the time that you're a child. You grow up with it. You don't even remember the first time you saw an image. She's always there in some form or the other. It took me a long time, though, to realize how long she's been there. More recently, I found that, you know, Paleolithic settlements in central India have known the goddess. That's what archaeological evidence suggests. You just, well, growing up, I knew none of that. I just saw images, calendar art, and of course, culture and iconography. All of that was familiar. But it was in the year 2010, you know, as late as that in my life, well after the spiritual journey had taken on a momentum and even a direction, after I met my guru. It was in the year 2010 that I went to this goddess temple in South India, in Coimbatore, a temple that had just been consecrated by my teacher. And I entered that temple with a certain openness because by then, you know, I was very much on the path. I was no longer a seeker at large. I was a committed seeker. I had a path of my own, which I still do. So I entered the temple, perhaps willing to, with a certain openness, because the notion of the goddess appeals to my feminist sensibilities, you know. And I thought, of course, I'd be happy to visit a goddess temple, though I wasn't quite sure why my guru had consecrated such a space, because he's very much a yogi and it's very much the path of inner work. And I wasn't quite sure what, you know, goddesses had to do with all that, but it didn't matter. I was curious. And I went in and sat there. And I remember the 33 names of the goddess being chanted. And as I just sat there listening to it and marinating in that space, not even meditating, just being there, something shifted so significantly that I knew this wasn't just an emotional response. It wasn't, certainly wasn't just some ideological response to the idea of the goddess. It was more like an energetic shift, as if some part of the self that had far too long been relegated to the shadows of my own consciousness had suddenly emerged simply because it had been acknowledged. So I don't think of it as being introduced to the goddess. I think of it as being reintroduced to her because it was the feeling of, oh my God, I've always known this. I've always known this. I wouldn't have even been able to articulate this at the time, but I did feel that I needed no one to tell me how to approach the goddess. I'd always known her. I'd always had my relationship. there was an intimacy and a familiarity and a great sense of homecoming and joy. So since then, since that moment in 2010, I think what had always been there latent has now come to the fore. And I've allowed that to, and there's a certain relief, and there's a certain joy, and there's gratitude for that. Until then, perhaps imperceptibly, not very subtly perhaps, I had begun to believe that the spiritual journey was somewhat, not grim, but somewhat cheerless, somewhat about grit-toothed penance. Though my relationship with my guru has never been about grit-toothed penance, there's always been a lot of joy and laughter there. But I must say that after I met the goddess, or met her again, and exhaled, I felt the festivity of life return, you know, to the ability to see life more as a festival rather than a battle. I think that's the shift she brought into my life.
That's really beautiful. Well, and I would love to, I think the question that's coming up for me is, do you think that the timing of that was significant in the fact that you had been on this spiritual path for many years before you had that? And I feel like that kind of takes us backwards to that point of which you you found your teacher. And so I wonder if we could, you know, let's maybe meander back there a little bit and kind of weave those two points together, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I think, there had been so many years of thrashing and flailing and floundering, Liz, since that 97 experience of wordlessness. I was looking desperately for guidance. And as I said, I started reading the mystics with a certain feverishness, because the mystics seemed to be the only ones, mystics from all over the world, the Sufi mystics, the Christian mystics, the Indian Hindu mystics, Buddhist, anyone who spoke of the sense of emptiness in a way that resonated with me. And they did, many did, you know, from St. John of the Cross, who came to my aid when I needed him, to so much magnificent poetry. All of that helped, but I realized I needed living guidance. It wasn't enough for me to live secondhand through books. But the whole question was, do gurus really exist anymore? Are they just a kind of figment of our imagination? Yes, the gurus existed. I had read about all the 20th century Indian mystics, Ramana Maharishi, Nisargadatta Maharaj, Ramakrishna Paramahansa earlier on, Shirdi Sai Baba, many. But where were they in my world was my question. And then in 2004, I walked into this auditorium in South Mumbai because I heard that there was this person called Sadhguru who was going to give a talk. And I went there and heard him. And there was a certain sense of, let me not underplay it. There was a great surge of recognition of a kind, but I wouldn't have given it that name at the time. It just felt like I needed to explore this further. So I did a program with him. After that, went up to him and said, can we just talk? Can we meet for a cup of coffee? You know? And that's when the journey started. And I ended up, you know, doing the programs, allowing the meditations to deepen. And his guidance for me was invaluable and has been invaluable. He was, for me, someone who offered verbal guidance, but also knew just when to stop, as I think every teacher must, and point me to my own inner guidance as well, which is for me the only sign that one has found a real teacher, someone who doesn't encourage you to just become dependent on him or her, but someone who is actually more committed to your freedom than you are yourself. And that for me was what my teacher was and is. So yes, had I not had all those years of quest and then of practice, I realized that the spiritual practice that I do, that was part of my life from 2004 onwards, certainly prepared me for that encounter with Devi, with the goddess, when I met her.
Yeah, and I would love, if it's okay with you, I would love to have you talk a little bit more about that relationship with Sadhguru, because I think that I know, in fact, from having many conversations, Western lens informed, that there is a deep misunderstanding about what it means to be in relationship with the guru. And I think especially, I can speak from experience, personal experience. I think there's a misunderstanding that, like within some patriarchal Christian traditions, for example, the priest is seen as the intermediary. Like you cannot speak to God without his intercession, which of course is, I believe, is problematic on so many levels, and particularly for women who are then taught that they cannot have a relationship with God on their own. And then there is the issue that I am certain that you're aware of these charismatic individuals positioning themselves as spiritual authorities and greatly abusing that power, especially with vulnerable folks in the West who do not have the spiritual maturity and the grounding to recognize. So I just wonder if you could speak and just provide some illumination around this concept of working with the guru, because I feel like it's really important to dispel some myths around that.
No, I'm glad you asked the question. And in fact, even in the book that we were just talking about
Yes.
earlier, the one that you mentioned, Women Who Wear Only Themselves, I start the book. I mean, the reason for growing interested in women on the path is because I think there are so many unspoken impediments. You know, just the language around spirituality is so permeated with I think very with connotations that we really need to look at and remove. One of them is just the word surrender. You know, I cannot think of a more loaded word than that, and a word that has been so abused, overused, misused. You know, it's a terrible word. And in fact, the word for me, as a very much as someone who saw herself as someone deeply energized and vitalized by my feminist inheritance, as much as I was a seeker. You know, so for me, some the words like surrender sounded like you had to turn into some puddle of servitude before, whether it was before your guru or your God, it didn't matter. I didn't want to be that. And I still don't, you know? So I think it took me time to understand, even someone like me who comes from an Indian background, not entirely unfamiliar with the notion of a guru, it took me time to understand that a guru is not a dictator. A guru is not a despot. A guru is not some kind of totalitarian figure in your life. If he or she had been, I don't think I'd have been in a relationship with a guru. I wouldn't have had a guru because that's not the way I could have been approached, even at, you know, in 2004 when I was desperate. I needed to have a relationship of some mutuality, certainly, and something that allowed me to ask questions and allowed me to doubt. Because doubt has been an integral part of my journey too, and it remains a part of my journey. So I think for me, when I met Sadhguru, I felt this was someone with whom I could have a conversation, where I felt the language, the vocabulary was shared into some degree. And this wasn't someone spouting scripture at me, which I would have been very uncomfortable with. I just wanted to talk about living and dying and terror and emptiness and all of that. So the conversation began and it deepened. And I'd say what I've realized along the way is, as I said earlier, one, the guru is always someone. You know you're on safe ground if the guru is actually guiding you back to yourself. Your attempt is not to become your guru. Your attempt is to become yourself, more deeply yourself. If that is happening, that's an index of whether this relationship is working, whether this wisdom tradition in your life has any value at all. Is it deepening your relationship with yourself? Is it putting you in touch with who you are? That to me is vital, I think. And the other is this whole business of surrender, which in fact has been perhaps the mainsprings of all of, you know, some of the books I've been working on now, including Wild Women, which is an anthology of women mystics in it, the Indian subcontinent down the ages, where I realized that what devotion means or bhakti means is not submission to authority. It is submission to love, which is quite a different thing. You know, so when it is submission to love, and it's not necessarily love with someone out there, it is actually the deepest commitment to yourself. That to me is devotion. That to me is bhakti. You're entering into a very deep sacred relationship with yourself. Externally, there is the dance of duality that goes on. For the outsider, it might seem like all you're doing, you know, what's going on is the self-abnegation of the devotee towards the teacher and so on. But what's going on inside is something quite different. And it's not about losing your spine. In fact, it is about reclaiming your spine. That's why I think women more than ever need to find a new vocabulary for their spiritual journeys. It's not about becoming spineless. It is about self-reclamation in its deepest possible way.
Yeah, I want to read something that you included in. I pretty much highlighted the entire preface of your book, Women Who Wear Only Themselves, but I want to read something that you wrote there. It feels relevant to what we're talking about, but you said, without consciously acknowledging the divine feminine, my life would have been unbalanced, lopsided. I needed the guru principle to remind me that derailment can be a kind of freedom. I needed the goddess to imbue a joyful sensuality into that discovery. The guru was the trap door that opened up and plunged me into a dark and ecstatic place of discovery. He is the guide who continues to teach me the crazy art of free fall. The goddess was the one who taught me that the trapdoor under my feet and the gates that open into the outer world aren't so different after all. So beautiful. I wonder if you, does that feel like a complete statement for you? Is there something you might add in this moment to what you wrote there in context of our conversation?
I'm not even sure I need to add anything. I think,
yeah.
You know, one sees so many. Once, you know, when you approach things with the mind, many things seem mutually exclusive. But on the journey, you realize what I call in this preface, the guru principle, the guru essence or the principle, and the notion of the goddess are so integral and so impossible to separate. I can't think of one without the other. And the coming together of that in some ways, of course, is indicative of a deeper inner reintegration between aspects, two aspects of the self that we often think of as disparate, you know, the more cerebral, the more rational, the more contemplative on the one hand, and the more emotional and exuberant and ecstatic on the other hand. How do these two come together? You know, whether you call it yin and yang or whether you call it ida pingala, it doesn't matter. The thing is, how do these various fragmented aspects of the self, how do they come together in a way that just feels natural, inevitable, and as I said earlier, almost festive,
mm-hmm.
joyous, not coming together in the way that I had perhaps unconsciously approached my spiritual journey earlier, which was as a kind of grim act of not self-denial, but certainly an act of kind of conscious meditation, sitting down and, you know, being sort of self-conscious about it. Somewhere between being self-conscious and being unconscious, when your life starts becoming more conscious, there is more joy and there's just more freedom.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me think of what you were saying about surrender too, because there's an aspect, I think, of surrendering our commitment to the storyline of separation, perhaps, or that this is over here and this is over here and they cannot exist together. And I've often reflected on how I feel like when I ask those kinds of questions, the answer that I feel like I receive from who I call the sacred feminine is always yes. It's just yes. There's a yes and there's a yes. There is no, this or that. It's always yes. It's a yes and.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I feel like there's such a beautiful invitation into multiplicity, mm-hmm. and holding complexity and paradox that comes with that, that I feel like where from where I sit, from a cultural perspective, we so desperately, desperately need right now.
You're absolutely right. I think that's the deepest invitation of one of the deepest invitations of the Divine Feminine. You know, she exists because, I mean, there are so many goddesses because they represent so many aspects of creation. So it is only in cultures and societies that understand the value of plurality that she can flourish. And when she returns, as she seems to be in some way into the world today, I think it is to remind us of that, to remind us of the great gift of plurality that that we need more desperately than ever, you know. And she helps, I think she helps us acknowledge that and celebrate that. She is definitely not about either or, you know, what you mentioned earlier. She is about this and that, and is vital. So that's the preposition that she represents. And she is the number three, not this, not that, both.
Oh, yes, I love that. Well, I'd love to hear you talk about this book. And I want to, I don't know, I don't believe your latest book is available in the United States yet, is it? Or
No,
is
do you
it?
mean
Okay.
wild women or do you mean women who wear only themselves?
I know
Women who.
women who wear only themselves because I read it. Although I did need to get an e-copy of it. It seemed quite tricky to get a hard
No,
a
I
paper
think it will be
copy.
published in the US next year, so it ought to
Wonderful. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I would love to talk with you about Women Who Wear Only Themselves, as that's the book that I was able to read here in the United States. I just was in love with it from the title. I thought, what a spectacular visual that gives us. And of course, you start with the first woman who is in fact wearing only herself, literally. But I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about the book and your inspiration behind it, and and what you received from really diving deep with these four women.
Yeah, I think as I said at the start of the book, I felt the need to hear women's voices. So that started me on a whole project as a poet and anthologist. I started looking at women mystics in India and so on. That's an ongoing project. In fact, it's just reached fruition, and it's an anthology called Wild Women. But somewhere along the way, while I was working on Wild Women, listening to the voices of mystics down the ages, I suddenly paused, and this happened during the pandemic, Liz. You remember those hours and months of silence, you know, that had descended on us all. And I found that the voices that were in my mind were the voices of some of the women I had met and known. And I realized that it was almost, it was silly, it was reductive of me to just think that the only women I should talk about were the women of the past, when there were in fact living women, contemporary women, who have in fact nurtured and who've inspired me in their own ways. So that's what made me sit down and start writing up conversations that have already happened. And two of these conversations were initially written. One of them was with this woman whom we'll talk about, the first woman of the book, a woman mystic outside in southern India, not so far from where I am now. I just accidentally, with a bunch of other people, we stumbled on her and found this woman. This radiant woman who inhabited herself in a certain way and was able to cast off all clothing and just, you know, meet us and greet us in all her naked magnificence. And there was her, and I had spent a long time interviewing her. It's, you know, it was a 4-hour interview. I started going back to the transcript of that interview, and I realized there was such richness. I owed it to someone. To some reader who was as strange as I was a listener. I believe there had to be some reader somewhere who was interested in this, what to me was a riveting conversation. So I started writing it up. And I started thinking also about this other woman whom I had met and whom I had also recorded, Bala Rishi, who is a woman who comes from, who's on the path of Nada Yoga, or the yoga of sound. And as I started looking at these, conversations, I realized that I just owed it to someone to put the book out there. And then two other women suggested themselves, and I knew it was complete. One is Lata Mani, who's someone I've known a long while, and whose journey in many ways has been inspirational to me. She's someone on the path of Tantra, and for whom the goddess is a living, very much a living reality. And there is this other person, Maka Puri, who's been my ally and comrade and a monk on her path, on very much on her own path. And I wanted her to be included because I know that many of us look at the path of monkhood as almost a medieval option. You know, it seems so strange. It's certainly not something I am drawn to. At the same time, I don't feel the need to judge it negatively simply because it's not my path. It just feels like the coming together of all these paths are a reminder of the plurality of journeys that human beings are called to make. So I felt that just the diversity of these women was reason enough for them to inhabit the same space in a book.
Well, and one thing that I loved about it too was how their paths were different. And going back to the conversation that we had earlier about your relationship with your guru, the first woman, her relationship was with a guru who's not alive, who she's never met, right? And the second woman, her relationship is directly with Shiva. She, I think if I'm remembering correctly, had no guru. She's just
no living,
called.
No life guru, yeah.
Yes. And then the third woman was working with a guru spiritual teacher at all. And then you had the fourth woman who
she
had chosen
the goddess to be her guru.
Yes. And then the fourth woman had, had devoted herself to that life of spiritual devotion in a very, what some may see as extreme. I can't find the right word. That's not what I mean, because I don't mean it in a judgment way, but just like a very focused way. So I found that very, I found that very interesting and inspiring too. The phrase many paths to the one heart is coming up.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think, I've had different people come up to me and talk about the book and always say, but that's the woman who's the real, she's the real thing. And I always find it amuses me because for me, each of them is wonderful and important in her own way. But depending on the temperament, the spiritual temperament of the reader, they're often inclined to say, no, this is the one. Oh, no, this is the one, and that's interesting to me too. For me, as a reader and as a listener and as a writer, all of them, with all their blazing singularity, each one of them is just wonderful in her own way.
Yes, it's interesting. I also found myself wondering, I was thinking of comparable women in the United States who I could, and at first I'm like, well, this can't happen here. Like, this is not even, I can't even imagine a woman established in a temple somewhere naked and people are actually coming to her for guidance and not to gawk and stare. And that may actually be true. I don't know if that's true or not, but then, I don't know. Actually, something clicked in this conversation. And as I was preparing for it, is that, and perhaps this is one of your points with writing this book, is that these women are around us. There are deeply, profoundly spiritual women who are defining their own spiritual paths, wearing only themselves in a variety of different ways. And just because we don't elevate them from a cultural standpoint does not mean they don't exist.
Absolutely. And also the fact that they're relatively unknown women, Liz, that was important to me too.
Yeah.
Not women seeking the limelight, women actually focused on being themselves. Yes, there's one who wears no clothes. Yes, there's one who's given up her ochre, the sacred colors, and is now periodically wears blue denim if she wants.
Yes.
And yes, there's someone else who's choosing to wear a monk's apparel. It doesn't matter. It's just that each one of them has found a journey that feels authentic enough for me to see them as women who wear themselves, or who are committed to wearing themselves.
Yes. Well, and I think, and I said this at the beginning when I was reading, before I read your bio, so I want to thank you for this. I don't think that I had thought about it in this way until I read your book, that this podcast that I do and these conversations that I host are really, in many ways, inspired by the same desire to shine a light on women who are doing this in their own ways. And most of them are not famous. And they're doing deeply profound and important work, but most of them are maybe not known at the highest levels of culture. And
Absolutely.
yeah.
You know, it struck me when I was reading a book on Hinduism, which I was doing, you know, around the time that I started this book. And I was reading the book, it interested me. But it struck me that all the people that were talked about were major male philosophers and reformers. And the women were just relegated to a chapter, you know, where they were just obedient followers and devotees, you know, Krishna devotees or Shiva bhaktas or whatever you call them. And I wanted to pause and say, yes, these are not women who founded a new sect, or they're not necessarily women who authored some scripture, but they are women leading magnificent lives of self-discovery and improvisation, and without whom our cultural and spiritual climate would be just so impoverished. And that was really part of the impulse to write the book. So I completely see your impulse, you know, to host a podcast of this kind, because there are just so many women working informally, anonymously, in the shadows, and who perhaps wouldn't have it any other way. Mm-hmm. And yet they need to be heard, sung, acknowledged. And I think it's all of us who yearn for this, Liz. You know, that's something that this book also brought home to me, because very recently, a few months ago, there was one of the women in the book, the last one, received a visitor. He was a judge of a particular high court in this part of southern India. He was drawn to her because he read about her in the book. He made a trip to visit her, all the way from his city to hers, sat with her and wept. And that's when I realized that there is a deep thirst, not just among women. There's a deep thirst among, it's there for everyone, a need for a less lopsided, unbalanced heritage of spirituality. We are all thirsting for it.
Yes. Yes, I had a similar experience around the winter solstice. I was in California, where I used to live, with a spiritual community that I'm still a part of. And there were many powerful women leading a ritual for the winter solstice. And I was so struck by how incredible it was to see women in their full and complete power holding this space. And in particular, the men that were there, I realized, like, ah, they need this perhaps as much, if not more, than I need it. It was really powerful to witness. And and I wonder if you would agree with this, but it seems to me there is no return of the divine feminine, right? She's already here. She's always been here. So there's a remembering of the sacred feminine, perhaps. But I wonder if this is part of it as well, is that rebalancing and recognizing that it perhaps should not look like, I don't want to say should, but it doesn't have to look like elevating women to this point of hierarchy. It's not really about hierarchy at all.
It's about the end of hierarchy.
Yes, yes. So in that case, highlighting stories of women who are perhaps not world famous is kind of, or, you know, making sure that we know this is kind of the point, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, not about the celebrities, even amongst the women. It's about those who are, and there are some wonderful women teachers, spiritual teachers in the world today. And, you know, they're deservedly very well known. But I wanted to just talk about all the, you know, some of the unknown, undocumented women, because there have been innumerable voices of this kind down the ages that we've never heard of.
Yeah.
And perhaps now never will hear of, other than attempts now made to document them, archive them, as I've tried to do in the forthcoming book, Wild Women, or attempts to dream our way into their lives.
Yes.
There are many works of fiction emerging that are about, you know, imagining what it might be, for instance, to be Yashodhara, the wife of the Buddha, What was it like for me? And so many others.
Yes. So yes. And I see that happening in Christian traditions too. People have been exploring who Mary Magdalene was and is for a long time. But yes, continuing to revisit that for sure. I want to ask you, and I wanted to read one more thing. There's a lot that I love from your book, so I wanted to read one more thing. But I wanted to ask you about, I started to say, recognizing that language always falls short when we are describing the divine, but perhaps as a poet, you are able to get closer to that than some. But to talk about your relationship and your connection to the sacred feminine, the divine feminine, however you want to call her, that relationship now, in this moment, in the
moment, isn't at this very moment or at this point in time, generally.
You know what? I'll let you answer that either way. Yes. Whichever way feels right for you in this moment.
Yeah. Okay. So I'd say, I talk about it a little in the preface, and I think I'd still stand by that I love what I call the theism of the relationship. I love the idea of being, of seeing her as the divine mother, as the wise, powerful friend, as all of that. I love that. At the same time, I love the notion of the cosmos as the womb. The sense that wherever you go, however much you digress, however much you're sidetracked, you can never step outside the great hospitality of her womb. That understanding for me has been so deeply sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, for me, another aspect of her that is very important. And then there is the sense of being so deeply related on, under the skin, that she is within me. So she's out there and she is within me. And I love the dance between the two. You know, that she's there and she's here. She is very, very concrete. I still enjoy going to that particular shrine in Coimbatore where I first met her or was first reintroduced to her. I love going there. So I love the concreteness and the local aspect of that relationship. I also love the way she is a portal to the immensity of creation and the universe. So that sense of the concrete and the universal, that sense of this figure with form, or just a shimmer of form, because she's the idol in that shrine she's like an egg with three eyes. That's the idol.
Mm.
And she's lovely. At the same time, she's an invitation to formlessness. So all those paradoxes, Liz, that we were talking of, which seem like contradictions when one just approaches them with the head, but when one approaches them with the heart, they're inspired paradoxes that all come together inevitably, seamlessly, beautifully. The fact that she's form and not form, that she is local and universal, the fact that she is mystery and revelation. She's both. She is the power of concealment and she is the power of clarity. You know, and that's the art of poetry as well. You know, so I recognize that part of her, of what she offers us. And to see her as outer and inner at the same time, to see her as objective and subjective at the same time, I enjoy that that dance.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what she is to me. And maybe I'd sum it up with a line. It's a one-line poem from my book, which perhaps sums it up better than I could, because poems are usually cleverer than I am. So this is the poem. It's called Goddess. And it's just a single line. It says, in her burning rainforest, silence is so alive. You can hear listening.
Mm. You've written so many beautiful things. There was something I was going to read, but I don't want to. I just want that to hang in the air, I think, instead, what you just said. I'd like to ask you about your spiritual practice and, just to the extent that you feel comfortable talking about that. But the reason that I ask is because I think, having had many conversations with women and also hosting this podcast with lots of women, there is a real, I think there's an innate knowing of the divine feminine and an extreme, okay, this is my perspective. I believe an extreme lack of credible spiritual teachers here in the West who can hold or even have any kind of understanding of her, let alone can hold it with integrity. And so I think that leaves women, and I'll say me too sometimes, with a real hunger and a perhaps a sense of confusion about how do I go, how do I deepen? And of course, there's always the inner listening, so we can be guided in that way. But I also think it's helpful to hear from women who have a deep connection with her, the ways in which they are cultivating and tending that flame. So I wonder if you're comfortable speaking to that, if you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I've had other friends who were on very different practices. For me, I can say that for me, Sadhguru was vital because he introduced me to a certain Kriya Yoga practice, which transform. If you meet a practice that fits you, and that practice was a fit, it fitted, and it continued. I'm not a terribly, I hang around things when I enjoy them. Otherwise, I would move away. I hang around poems because I like words, or I hang around art because I like beauty. The practice never felt like something I was doing in a self-conscious way. It just felt natural and it just kept deepening. There are times it felt tedious, but most of the time I can tell the day when I haven't done it and the day that I've done it. So I do it because I know the difference. So as that practice deepened, I think in many ways it was preparing me for my moment with the goddess too, because I recognize her as a certain energetic experience. And that's what she is to me. She is a particular kind of vibration. And the receptivity to that vibration is all that I can really work at. The rest is not, it's about, that's about as much as I can do. And how we work at our receptivity, I think, is different for each one of us. On certain days, just sitting at what I call the poet's workshop, which is just sitting around words and silences, that might do the trick. But to have a regular path that is nonverbal, particularly for someone like me who otherwise uses words as her trade and her life, to have a nonverbal path, a regular daily practice, has become hugely important. I can't think of my life without it. So Kriya Yoga for me has been important in that regard. That, along with a certain meditation, which I've also learned in my years with Sadhguru, for me, this is what I do. The rest of the time, I just hang around her. I just drink her in, But I feel these are the only things I actively do to perhaps hone my receptivity.
I love that. You hang around and drink her in. It's beautiful. I'm feeling complete. However, I want to ask you if there's anything else that you'd like to share before we wrap up that I haven't asked you or that you would like to bring forward in this conversation.
No, I just love the way it's unfolded, and there seems to be a flow to things, Liz. I don't think we need to add anything. It would have been said had it needed to be. I think the flow has been lovely. I really don't think that.
Yeah, I agree. Arundhati, it's been so lovely to be in conversation with you. I'm really grateful for your time. I'm also aware we're working with a significant time difference. So, I appreciate you making this work on your end, and just sharing your thoughts and your presence with me and with our listeners today. I'm very grateful.
Thank you, Liz. I look forward to a deepening conversation, but I think we've covered so much terrain in this one that I'm actually surprised and very grateful. Thank you.
Wonderful. Yes. And so Arundhati's book, which you can get here in the United States, you need to get it in ebook. That's how I got it, is Women Who Wear Only Themselves. She also has many beautiful books of poetry. I'm going to put links to all of this in the show notes, and I will keep my fingers crossed. Your next book, Wild Women, will be available here in the United States. And perhaps when it's out and in the world, if you want to come back and join me and talk about it, I'd be honored to have you back.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to Women Who Wear Only Themselves coming out in the US, which it will next year, apparently.
Wonderful. That's awesome. And so thank you all to all of you for tuning in. I'm so grateful for you spending some time to participate in these conversations that so much feed my soul. And the fact that you're here is part of that nourishment. So thank you. And if you like this show, there's a few things you can do. You can tell your friends about it. You can subscribe to it. You can leave it a favorable review. You can do all those things if you feel so inspired. And until next time, I hope you take very good care of yourself, and I'll be with you again soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com. where you can find show notes and other episodes, you can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.